Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Ed Morin. Today we take you to the Portland Club in downtown Portland for a talk to the World Affairs Council of Maine by R. Nicholas Burns, Professor of the Practice of Diplomacy and International Politics at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Burns served in the U.S. government for 27 years and was a career Foreign Service officer. Among his many roles, Burns was Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs from 2005 to 2008, U.S. Ambassador to NATO from 2001 to 2005, and U.S. Ambassador to Greece from 1997 to 2001. He was State Department spokesman from 1995 to 1997. On today's Speaking in Maine, we'll hear Professor Burns speaking about today's foreign policy challenges. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. It will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear this program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Here from the Portland Club and the annual meeting of the World Affairs Council of Maine, R. Nicholas Burns.
I thought I'd just try to give you a sense of the complexity that we face as we look out across the Atlantic towards Europe or the Pacific towards Asia or South in our own hemisphere towards Central and South America and Africa. I don't want to exaggerate how difficult a time this is for the United States, but I think it's a very difficult time. Not the most fateful time, that was the revolution that Mainers and people from Massachusetts fought together. Not the most dangerous time, that was the Civil War, when, you know, we lost, every family statistically lost someone. I've read the Shara book. I know all about Chamberlain at Little Round Top, if you're Bodengrads. He was a great hero of that war. But I think it may be the most complex international agenda we've ever faced. Part of that because we live in a highly integrated global environment. 19th century Americans, even early 20th century Americans, they told themselves, you know, the Atlantic and Pacific will protect us. We can be shielded from the rest of the world. No longer. Not with the internet, not with jet travel, not with nuclear weapons, not with global terrorism, not with 21 young men coming into our country and taking down the World Trade Center towers and bombing the Pentagon and killing 3,000 people. So we live in a connected world. And I don't want to be too dark about this. Tom Friedman, whom I greatly respect, wrote a great book about globalization more than 10 years ago, The Lexus and the Olive Tree. And Tom said, look, there is a dark side of globalization, but there's a bright side as well. And I'm going to finish with hope tonight. So as we go through these very difficult problems, there's hope at the end. But I think it is enormously complex. And it's complex because we're the world leader. That's not an arrogant statement. That's a factual statement. There's no other country that provides the political and economic and military leadership that the United States does. Professor John Eikenberry is a really brilliant professor at Princeton, wrote a book 2 years ago about American foreign policy. He said, there is an international system. It's highly defined in its legality, its structure. It's the trade system. It's the military alliances. It's the rule of law. And the United States is the system operator. And if we're not at the helm, if we retreat into isolation, which we Americans have done routinely and regularly throughout our history, from the beginning of the Republic to this time, the system doesn't function. And as I look ahead towards 2016, I've just read Hillary Clinton's book, amazing book. I really liked it. Gives you really good insights into who she is. I think she's an impressive woman. But she sees the risk of isolation and she sees the need for leadership. President Obama just gave a big speech about American leadership at West Point at the commencement there. Jeb Bush is thinking about American leadership. Some of the people who may or may not be in our future, who may or may not run for president, I've named two of them, one Democrat, one Republican. I think what we all fear is incipient isolation. If you look at the left wing, and I'll be an equal opportunity critic here, I was a civil servant, so I worked both Republicans and Democrats. Left wing, the Democratic Party, the extreme left of the party right now in Congress, highly isolationist. Want to bring all the American troops home, don't want to pay for the defense or diplomatic budgets. especially true on the right wing of the Republican Party with the Tea Party. I don't want to offend anybody here. You may be, some of you, members of these groups, and you have a right to your views. I just find isolationism to be a big problem for us. Highly rational choice in 1814, when we were in our autarkic economy, when we truly could live here on our own and didn't really need the rest of the world. We can't survive without trade with China. We can't survive without China owning a billion dollars of our treasury bills. We can't survive without the Europeans, who are our largest trade partner and largest investor. We can't survive without our allies. Boy, we found out in Iraq and Afghanistan, we need allies in the world and friends, and we need to call upon them. Can't be alone in the world. And I think that's the big danger that a lot of people see. That's my first point. Second, about complexity. Think of Barack Obama's inbox. I mean, just imagine his life. Seems like a nice life, right? He lives in this big, beautiful White House. He doesn't have much of a commute down the elevator, through the Rose Garden, into the side door of the West Wing, built by Theodore Roosevelt. But on that desk, two big inboxes, one with domestic issues. I'm not competent to comment. I'm a citizen, but I don't have any particular expertise on energy or welfare or health policy. But there's also a foreign policy inbox a mile high with problems. The global recession, Iran trying to become a nuclear weapons power, North Korea with nuclear weapons. And here's a guy, a 30-year-old guy, no previous employment experience, no previous management experience, runs what is no more than a Tony Soprano-like family mafia dictatorship. That's what it is. Not a government. It's a wholly owned family enterprise. Executed his uncle a couple of months ago because his uncle was too rich. The only known American who's ever talked to him and spent time with him is a very good ex-basketball player, but probably not the kind of guy, Dennis Rodman, you want to negotiate a nuclear weapons agreement with the North Koreans. So it's a dangerous world if you're Barack Obama and you have Iran and North Korea running amok, challenging the international order. You have the global recession just behind us with India slowing down, Brazil slowing down, China showing cracks, the United States economy not growing the last two quarters, essentially. We're flat. We're adding some jobs, but not nearly enough to create even 1 or 2% growth in GDP. And so he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders, and I think all of us, no matter what you think of President Obama, I deeply admire and respect him. We should want him to succeed in fighting the terrorist threats that have reappeared this week in Iraq, in trying to keep the world stable, in trying to bring the Israelis and Palestinians together, trying to keep China from dominating the Philippines and Vietnam and Japan and Korea as it is trying to do. So a tough, tough global agenda for the president. And just to break this down, because the assignment I've been given is to talk about our future security in 2014, national security challenges, we could design a really good course at the University of Maine, University of Southern Maine, or Harvard on that subject, but it'd take us all semester to go through those issues. So I thought what I'd do is just pick three issues, symbolic, emblematic of the complexity, the difficulty of these challenges we face. And the three are: what's happening with Europe, with Vladimir Putin drawing new divisive lines, number one. Number two, the burning Middle East. And number three, the rise of China and why that's important to Americans. On the first one, Putin seemed to be having a pretty good time at the Sochi Olympics. And the last day of the Olympics is when he decided to go into Crimea, because Yanukovych, his buddy, fled. It looked like these very dangerous people who wanted to promote a trade agreement with the European Union, that was the casus belli, we're going to take Ukraine in a westward direction, and Putin's a 20th century guy. He was formed by the KGB. He's a zero-sum leader. So if I win, you lose. If you win, I lose. He's not very much of a 20th century, first century leader who might think that the global good, you know, is when both of us win. When he saw Ukraine even thinking about a trade agreement, and that's all it was, it wasn't about membership in the EU, it wasn't certainly about membership in NATO, he decided he would invade Crimea, and then not just invade, then formally annex it by an act of the Russian Duma. We haven't seen any major European country do that since the 1930s, and you know who I'm talking about. And I'm not making the comparison. Nobody compares to Adolf Hitler in their evil and barbarity. barbarism. But Putin has just taken over another part of another country, Crimea. And he's destabilizing eastern Ukraine. His strategy, I think, is not to own Ukraine. Ukraine's the largest country west of Russia in Europe. It has a sick economy, a lot of corruption, almost a failed state. He doesn't want to own that problem. He wants to destabilize it and weaken it and divide it so that Ukraine cannot be an attractive partner to the European Union. Very simple strategy. I wish we had a map. I should have brought one. But, you know, imagine you can see Russia, that vast country 12 time zones across. To the south of Russia and the Caucasus, you have Armenia and Georgia. The Russians have effectively said to the Armenians and Georgians, you will not have permanent arrangements with the European Union and NATO, and they invaded Georgia in 2008 to prove that point. If you think of the states that then swing around to the west of Russia, Moldova and Ukraine and Belarus, the Russians have made the same threat. You are in what we call our near abroad. You are part of our neighborhood. You always have been. You're not breaking free, and we will use force against you if you try. Or, as they did yesterday, they decided, the Russians, to cut off all natural gas supplies to Ukraine, just to prove that they own the gas and the Ukrainians don't. And so we've got power politics to the max, and he's drawing new lines between Eastern Europe and Western Europe. And a lot of us in this room, not everybody, not the young people at this table, but a lot of us grew up during the Cold War. We remember a Europe divided by Stalin and Khrushchev and Brezhnev. And the great miracle of 1989, 1990, 1991, when the Warsaw Pact imploded, all those countries became independent, was that Europe would be, in the words of someone who spends his summers in Kennebunkport, George H.W. Bush, who just parachuted out of a plane on his 90th birthday, Bush 41, as we call him. He said in 1991, Europe is now whole, free, and at peace. And Europe had been none of those things through the entire time of the First or Second World Wars, or several hundred years before that. What a miracle European unity has been for the people of Europe. It's the largest economy in the world, 515 million people. It's the wealthiest part of the world. I would say, as an admirer, in terms of the rule of law and human rights, one of the most just places on earth. Great environmental consciousness. They're the leaders of climate change in the world. And here's Putin, who's an outsider, who said infamously the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century, he said, was the collapse of the Soviet Union. That tells you a lot about who he is and how he views the world. He is now reimposing those divisions on Europe. What a shame to see that happen 23 years after the collapse of the evil empire, in Ronald Reagan's phrase, the Soviet Union. What do we do about it? I think there's been a fairly anemic Western response. I don't think President Obama wants to be weak in response. I think the European problem is they're hooked on Russian natural gas. Six European countries, 100% reliant on Russian natural gas. Six others, 80% reliant on Russian natural gas. And when Crimea was invaded and eastern Ukraine destabilized, the business community in Germany rose up as one and said, no sanctions. Our contracts are too important with the Russian economy. And so Angela Merkel, who's the real leader of Europe now, has held Europe back, and most of the West Europeans have, from significant sanctions that would really impose a penalty on Putin. The only thing he really understands is counter-pressure. And since we're not going to fight him and shouldn't fight him, we don't have any moral or legal obligation to fight for Ukraine, it's not a part of NATO, but we want to impose a cost so he doesn't go further, we're not imposing much of a cost because the West Europeans won't have it. And the Canadians and Americans, I think, would have a stronger response if we could team up with Europe. Happy to talk about this. It's just thoroughly dispiriting. I've been in Europe 3 times in the last 3 months, and the Europeans are very concerned, the population, about what's happening. And I don't think we're returning to the Cold War, but Cold War passions have been unleashed. That's just a comment on the big issue now, that we need to stay engaged in Europe because the United States, still the strongest outside power, still the leader of NATO. We provide for the defense of Europe through the NATO alliance. Issue number two is the Middle East. Everybody remembers, even the young people at this table, Tahrir Square, right? January, February of 2011, those young people in the streets, a million in the central square in Cairo, not demonstrating against us for once, demonstrating a little bit for an end to corruption, free market economy, liberal politics, meaning democratic, small d, politics, end to the religious wars. And you saw in Tunis, in Cairo, in Amman, in Damascus, in Yemen, in Sana'a, you saw that was the call. And I was hopeful. And my wife and I, kids, had lived in Israel, we'd lived in Egypt, we lived in Mauritania, we knew the Middle East. I knew it was authoritarian. I knew the Middle East was not going to be an easy place to be transformed, but a lot of people thought, I, myself included, there's a chance we could be looking at a revolutionary moment in the most positive sense in the world. And if you now track what's happened 3.5 years later, exactly 3.5 years later, we might be able to make an argument that Tunisia and Morocco are better off in North Africa. But everybody else in their 22 Arab states, the 20 other Arab states, are in a process of revolution, disintegration, open civil war or warfare. Think of Egypt, the keystone state in the Middle East. 85 million people, the historic civilization, the cultural and political trendsetter. Egypt, throughout Mubarak, right? They elected the Muslim Brotherhood. The military came back and threw out the Muslim Brotherhood government, the democratically elected government. The top general has just taken off his uniform and put on a suit and ran for election. About 30% of the people voted. He got about 99.996% of the votes. And he's now the new Mubarak, the new dictator. We're right back to square one in Egypt. Nobody will invest because the government of Egypt, the military government, has said to the Muslim Brotherhood, if you're a member of that party, and by the way, I have no love for the Muslim Brotherhood, they did not acquit themselves well in government, but they were elected. The government has said, if you're a member of the party, and there's several million people who are members, average people in Egypt, you are hereby branded as a terrorist. In a recent trial in provincial Egypt, east of Cairo, 539 average citizens were sentenced to death for their membership in the Muslim Brotherhood. There is a big fight coming, unfortunately, in Egypt. Maybe more bitter and more violent than anything we've seen in the last 3.5 years. And that's the keystone state. Syria, 22.4 million people in the country, 9.3 million refugees. 9.3 million refugees. There isn't a country in the world, no country, with as high a percentage of its population refugees, meaning they've lost their homes, they've lost their jobs, they're on the run. The minority of the 9.3 million are in Iraq, Jordan, and Turkey as refugees. The majority are just fleeing the fighting inside Syria, living in tent cities, living in the summer out in the open. Kids can't go to school. The refugee population is, however, so great even outside, there are more Syrian refugee kids in the schools in Lebanon this month than Lebanese kids. And so this civil war is metastasizing. Assad, the brutal dictator, just strong enough to survive. The rebel alliance, weak enough, disputatious enough, not united enough to win. The civil war continues. It will continue for the next couple of years because nobody wants to stop it. Whenever the U.S. and Britain or France go to the Security Council in New York and say, let's have a resolution to extend humanitarian assistance, the Russians and Chinese veto it. Whenever we go to New York and say to the Security Council, let's have a political process to reconcile these warring factions, the Russians, Iranians, and Hezbollah are the protectors of the Assad government, and the Turks, the Arabs, the Europeans, and the Americans and Canadians are the protectors of the various rebel groups. One of those groups, ISIS, you've heard a lot about them in the last week, emerged as the strongest rebel group about a year and a half ago. They now control most of northern Syria. They are a Sunni group. They want to establish a religious state, what they would call a religious caliphate, in Syria and Iraq. They want to unite the Sunnis against the Shia. The Alawites, part of the Shia clan in Syria, and the Shia majority, the population in southern Iraq. What you have now is the possible dismemberment of both Syria and Iraq right now, this summer. This one terrorist group, a lot of people have said, is more virulent, more vicious than Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda was. There were reports last weekend of mass executions in Mosul when the ISIS army, the Sunni fighters, went into the second largest city in Iraq. The two divisions of the Iraqi army fled before 4,000 or 5,000 fighters. They went into that city and they executed hundreds, if not thousands, of people. There's a real crisis underway. And I was in Washington today asking people, what's the president going to do? And I have tremendous sympathy with the president. We just got out of Iraq. You know, we lost 4,500 soldiers. We had 25,000 American soldiers wounded. Well over 100,000 Iraqi civilians dead in the war, our war. We invaded in 2003. The president won't put troops back on the ground, and he shouldn't. But if he doesn't use American air power, and I'm not necessarily advocating this, but if he doesn't use American air power to strike back on behalf of the government in Baghdad against this new terrorist army in the western and northern parts of Iraq, you can be sure who's going to come in to give that assistance. Iran. Iran's Revolutionary Guards will come in to Iraq. That is a tough choice for our president. I would imagine he's going to do something militarily, but he's going to exact, hopefully, some compromises from this very narrow-minded government in Baghdad. It's a mess. And we're once more right in the middle of it because, again, we're the country that can make a difference. And so whether people like us or not, they call us. We can talk about that as well, the burning, divided Middle East. Last issue to think about, and we could have talked about 7 or 8 of these big, big themes, is the rise of China. Part of it's a very inspiring story. Fastest economic growth rate in recorded history, China since Deng Xiaoping's reforms of 78-79. Greatest number of people lifted out of poverty in human history, China, over the last 3 decades. Now the leading manufacturing economy in the world. Second largest economy by gross domestic product. Largest trade partner with Japan, with South Korea, with India. One of our most significant trade partners. Rising military power. Second strongest in the world after the United States. Creating a blue water navy. Creating a modern nuclear weapons force. There's a nationalist spirit, sentiment, scourge, whatever you call it, in China right now. They want to piece back together historic China. Because for the last 2 centuries, we and the Europeans basically carved it up in the open door policies from 1840 all the way to the Second World War. And in a sense, it's payback time. The Chinese want to reestablish the Middle Kingdom. And so you see under Xi Jinping, the new leader, who's been in power for 1.5 years, a much more aggressive China than we've seen since Mao, when he struck back against MacArthur at the beginning of the Korean War. Well over 60 years ago. What have the Chinese been doing? They've been going into the South China Sea. It's not their lake. And they've been contesting the sovereignty of 6 different countries, including Vietnam and the Paracel Islands, including our ally, the Philippines, including Brunei and Malaysia, and including Taiwan. And they've been saying, all those islands are ours. All that oil beneath those islands is ours. The Chinese don't have a leg to stand on under the Law of the Sea Treaty, which is the law of the land. They don't own any of this territory, but because they're powerful and these smaller states are relatively weaker, the Chinese just bully them. 2 weeks ago, they went and they blew up a Vietnamese fishing boat. They've contested the Filipino sovereignty at Scarborough Shoals. President Obama's responded by saying, we're going to put American troops into the Philippines. We're going to renew our defense agreement with the Philippines in the East China Sea. China's contesting Japanese sovereignty over the Senkaku Islands. The Chinese have a big view of what China is, and it rarely comports with international law. Now, here's the problem. We can never fight the Chinese, because it would be catastrophic for the two most powerful militaries in the world to fight each other in the 21st century, in the nuclear weapons age, in the chemical weapons age. And so we've got to do 2 things at once with the Chinese. And I tell my students, when we talk about this, this is the most important issue for your lifetime. It's the most important issue for the rest of our lifetimes. How do we do 2 things at once with China? How do we be China's most important partner on climate change, on fighting terrorism, on fighting trafficking of women, on fighting the drug cartels? Because these are global scourges that the two most powerful countries have to team up and combat them together. So we'll have a coincidence of interests that bind us to China. That's good. At the same time, we're going to be China's largest competitor for military power in Asia, and they'll be our largest competitor. We've never had a relationship since the founding of our republic with such contrasting poles to it. We're going to be the strongest partner and the most bitter competitor for power with the same country. Put it another way, a friend of mine at Harvard, Steve Bosworth, who was ambassador to the Philippines, ambassador to South Korea, and President Obama's North Korea negotiator, he now teaches with us. Steve came and talked to my class in early April, and he said the following statement. I made him repeat it because it was such a big statement. He told my students, containing Chinese power and yet not getting into a war with China will be the most difficult thing the United States has ever done. He said it just like that. I said, Steve, Ambassador, I said, you've got to repeat that statement. What did you say? He said, this will be the most difficult challenge we've ever faced as a country in 2.5 centuries. Now, whether you agree with the statement or not, it's a big statement. It helps us to frame the challenge. In many ways, power in the world, economic, political, military, the Chinese and Americans own more of it, way more than any other group of countries do. The 21st century is going to be about whether we can work together. Let's take climate. We're the 1 and 2 carbon emitters in the world. If we don't do something like what President Obama did with the coal industry 2 weeks ago Monday, then climate change never gets resolved because we're just spewing too much carbon. The Chinese and American economies and the Indian economy, the top three, into the atmosphere. We've got to work with the Chinese, and the Chinese are responding because it's a public opinion issue in that authoritarian state. People don't want to live in a Beijing where you can't see in January and February 15 feet in front of you because the smog is so thick. And I was there in January of 2013, and you could barely see down the street because the air quality was so bad. The Chinese public is outraged, and in their internet blogging culture, they're pushing their government, and the Chinese government's now responding. They're starting to do things on climate, so we can work with them, but we shouldn't want to be dominated by them. We've been there. Well, we're a Pacific nation. We've been in the Pacific forever, since we got to the west coast of the United States. But specifically, we've been in Asia since September 2nd, 1945. That was the date of the Japanese surrender to MacArthur. And since then, we've been the dominant military power through our alliances, South Korea, Japan, Australia, Philippines, and Thailand. And now new security agreements with India, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, and Vietnam. I remember the Vietnam War. It ended my junior year in high school. Some of you will have even a sharper memory of that war. We probably even have some Vietnam vets here. It is ironic in the extreme to hear the Vietnamese saying to us now, please come back and reestablish your naval base at Cam Ranh Bay. Please come back with your Air Force, because they've had a 1,000-year competition, Vietnam and China, and they don't want to be dominated by China. And so wherever you go in the world today, I think the dominant refrain is, you Americans need to lead. And we were talking at our table about this. The last two presidents, and I worked for every administration from Jimmy Carter to George W. Bush. I never had the fortune to work with President Obama. I would say, objectively, that one of the issues we had in the Bush administration, I served in that administration, is that we caused a lot of apprehension about American power in the world. We were in people's faces. We invaded and occupied two countries. There were reasons for that. I'm not apologizing. But I think by the end of the George W. Bush presidency, one of the international sentiments that was strong in some places was too much American power. In the fifth year of President Obama's presidency, the familiar refrain now is too little American power. Where's the leader? Where's the leader? The president drew a line in the sand against Assad last September and said, if you use chemical weapons, I will hit you. Assad used chemical weapons twice, and nothing happened. The president decided not to use air power. It was a decision that won public approval here, as you know. Public opinion polls backed the president. In my family, I was against what the president did. my wife and three daughters all in favor of what the president did. So, you know, families can be divided by these issues. The consequence, however, in the cynical, cruel, bitter world of the Middle East dictators is that nobody fears us anymore. In the Middle East, you do want to be feared. It's not just about respect. It's about being respected for your power, and that is not the case right now with the United States. So we've got a job to do in this country. Get the balance right. Is there a centrist position where we are leading with diplomacy, which we should do, where we very rarely use the military, which I think we should do, very rarely do, but we are also not afraid to express our power when dictators or terrorist groups confront the world with unacceptable choices? And it's difficult to find that center for any president. I think President Obama's done a lot of good things, but it's a time of testing for him. The mood and atmosphere in Washington is a very difficult one right now. What are they going to do in Iraq? It's going to be a big problem. I've left you with so much despair and so much that is disappointing about the world. Is there hope? And the answer is, there are a lot of good things happening too. And I say this because my wife has been to far too many of my talks. And about a year ago, she said to me, you're really good at diagnosing what the problems are. Is there any hope here? And that was a really good recommendation. Here's the hope. Global poverty, 7.5 billion people on Earth, well over 2.5 billion people living below the poverty line. But here's a Nick Kristof, if you know Nick Kristof, who writes for the New York Times, statistic from about 5 months ago. Nick wrote, in 1980, one of every two human beings lived below the UN poverty line, which is, if you make $2.25 a day or less, you are below that poverty line. In 1980, one of every two of us around the world was legally poor. In 2014, one of every five. There has been one of the great stories of our time, little reported in the American press, is the tremendous alleviation of poverty in China, in India, in Brazil, and in certain countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Still too much of it, obviously, when you have over 2.5 billion people, 40% of whom live in India, poor, but this is tremendous progress. In terms of global public health, Bill Gates and Mayor Michael Bloomberg have each put tremendous amount of their own money into polio research and vaccinations, as has the U.S. government, as has the United Nations. Polio nearly eradicated from the face of the earth, except for Pakistan, Afghanistan, northern Nigeria, and now a polio outbreak in Damascus over the last several months. If we can inoculate those kids in some of these Muslim areas where parents don't want their kids inoculated, polio can be eradicated in 3 or 4 years. Bill Gates came to Harvard for our campaign kickoff in October. He said malaria can be eradicated from the face of the earth in our lifetime because of the tremendous progress being made in global public health by the African countries with the help of the UN, the US, and the Gates Foundation. Guinea worm and river blindness can be eradicated in our lifetime. These are tremendous gains, particularly for poorer people around the world. That's second. Third, we're about to become the largest energy power in the world. Who would have believed that 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years ago? We thought 10 years ago we'd have to import natural gas from the United States. We're now going to export to Europe and Asia. Because what's happening, I know it's very controversial, with shale gas and shale oil, the United States will be the leading oil and gas producer in the world by 2018. Canada, Mexico, and the United States together, the leading energy center of the world. This is an enormous gift in terms of prices, price of energy, if it all works right. It's an enormous gift for the power of the United States not to have to rely on Arab autocrats or the Hugo Chavez's of the world as we did for the last several decades. It's a double-edged sword. If my wife were here, she's my conscience. She'd say, yeah, but what are the consequences for climate change? And she's right. It's a double-edged sword. Natural gas is a lot cleaner than coal. The president's taking us off coal and is committing us to natural gas. That's clearly a transition to a more highly developed energy economy in the future, but it's a lot better situation than we've ever been in my lifetime. And last thing I'd say why we should be hopeful, the great powers are at peace. I say that partially because we're 100 years after Sarajevo, end of June 1914, a dusty corner of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, one act, the assassination by a teenager of the Austrian Grand Duke Franz Ferdinand, touched off a war in which 16 million people died. And then a generation later, because scores needed to be settled, 60 million people died in the next world war that a lot of our parents came of age in. We have nothing like that on the horizon. Knock on wood. Nothing. If we go on the net, you know, and visit the thousands of websites available to us, it looks like the world's on fire because it's just so present in front of our eyes. Civil war in Somalia, civil war in Sudan, civil war in the Central African Republic, vicious civil war in the Congo, and now this terrible civil war in Iraq as well as Syria. It looks like the world's on fire. But Russia is not actually fighting Germany over Ukraine. And China and the United States are not at war. And India and China are not at war. And Brazil hasn't fought anybody in 140 years. And so we really have this unbelievable situation of a relative peace. This professor at Harvard, Steve Pinker, says it's the most peaceful time in the last several hundred years. Who knew? Because our newspapers are filled with gloom, doom, and problems. This one thing to glory in. But here's the thing about great powers of peace. We need to keep it so. And I'd leave you with this thought. No matter what we do, the United States has to lead in the world, and we have to be present, and we have to be a faithful friend, and can't retreat and dig a moat around the country as the Tea Party would have us do. And as some of the left, my friends, especially from Cambridge, Mass, on the left, would have us do, is to slash the military and State Department budgets and essentially say we're tired after the two big wars and the recession, we're going to go home. If we resign as the global leader, there's nobody waiting in the wings. Read a brilliant essay in The New Republic by Robert Kagan. And he says, if this democratic superpower falters, there's nobody waiting in the wings to lead the world. It's up to us to do it. That's my parting thought. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. Today's speaker was longtime U.S. Foreign Service officer R. Nicholas Burns, who is now professor of the practice of diplomacy and international politics at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He spoke recently at the annual meeting of the World Affairs Council of Maine, which was held at the Portland Club in Portland, Maine. If you'd like to purchase a taped copy of today's Speaking in Maine, please call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. Again, for a copy of today's Speaking in Maine with Nicholas Burns, the number to call is 1-800-884-1717. You can also listen to the program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcast to access the program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. The executive producer of Speaking in Maine is Charles Beck. I'm Ed Morin. Thanks for listening.